It's Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we get advice from a doctor on how to talk to your friends and family who may be worried about getting vaccinated. But first, in order to curb the spread of COVID-19, Wisconsin colleges and universities have changed how they operate. One big change this year, no spring break. UW-Milwaukee students and staff did get spring break, but many other campuses, UW-Madison, UW-Eau Claire, UW-La Crosse, as well as Marquette, chose to cancel. Some schools offset the loss with a few days spread out across the calendar. Our next guest spoke to many college students about what this has meant for them. Many are experiencing burnout. Some have lost needed income that they normally get from working jobs over the break. And we want to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Are you a college student and didn't get a spring break? What did you do? Do you think your school made the right decision? Give us a call. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. We have with us Davey Shastri, the statewide higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, which is part of the USA Today network. Davey, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Molly.
Glad to speak with you. So give us the lay of the land. How many schools canceled spring break this year?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, for this story, I didn't get a comprehensive list, but it definitely seems like a good number of them if we were to just look at the UW system. I wouldn't say it was the majority, though. And a lot of schools did what they normally do and had spring break, but it really depended on kind of the local situation there. So Madison was the big one that canceled, UW-Eau Claire, UW-La Crosse. And then we saw some private schools like Marquette also make that decision to cancel the break.
And what were administrators' chief concerns in taking this action?
I think the biggest concern, and it's definitely a reasonable one, was that students during spring break usually travel. A lot of students travel, and it's known to be, you know, the break where you go and hang out on the beach and spend some time just relaxing and getting some rest. And the fear was that if students were to do that during the COVID pandemic, that they would bring COVID back to campus.
Right. Florida seeing large numbers mm-hmm. of variant cases right now. So you spoke with a number of students for your story. And how did this go over?
So, yeah, I talked to a lot of students and also just got a lot of reaction from social media. And the general sense was, you know, a lot of people understood, a lot of students understood why realistically this decision was made to curb the spread of COVID. But the reality turned out to be that a lot of students are facing just massive amounts of burnout throughout this school year. And they were at the point where they were like 9 or 10 weeks into the school year when I was writing this story and realizing, you know, it feels like there's no end in sight. It feels like you just got to keep staring at your computer screen and getting through your classes without that break. So a lot of people were really exhausted.
Yeah. Do we know how faculty responded? Did you see faculty members taking a break on their students, trying to accommodate them?
It depends on the faculty member. And that was another thing that I learned while reporting this story, is that at the end of the day, you know, the university can say, hey, we're going to give you a couple of days off here and there, but it's the faculty's, you know, ultimate control of what they want to do with their class schedule. And a lot of them, you know, do have to meet a certain number of, you know, class hours and cover a certain amount of material that, you know, some of them decided that they wouldn't be able to build in the break. Maybe there wasn't class on, you know, UW-Madison students got a Friday, a Saturday, and then another Saturday at one point throughout the semester off. But a lot of students said they still had assignments due. And so it really varied from professor to professor. I also talked to one professor who gave students 2 weeks off for midterms. And they were, you know, working on their projects and able to communicate with that professor, but there was no formal class during that time. So it really depends.
Well, let's bring on one of the students you spoke with. We have with us Joni Kierzik. She's a sophomore studying neurobiology and psychology at UW-Madison. Welcome to Central Time, Joni.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, thanks for joining us. So tell us what your reaction was. You know, you're a student at Madison. When you learned there was no break in sight for you.
I was pretty surprised. They ended up canceling our spring break in September, and students never got a formal email about it. We found out through one of the news networks, actually.
And how did you feel when you heard that news?
I was very disappointed. I know myself and a lot of other students, it would be using the spring break to catch up and to study and to at least relax and have a day off, because it's really hard to do that while you're in classes. And so it was just very upsetting.
Do you think, based on your friends, do you think the concerns were real that the administration had, that students would be going home to their families or traveling maybe somewhere warmer and inadvertently helping to spread COVID? Do you think that's a real concern?
Yes, I understand the concern. However, because all of or a majority of our classes have been online, it gives students the opportunity to still travel, and they can do classes or something else in a different location, such as Florida or Boston, and they can still travel because of the online classes.
Right. So what has this meant for you, having to continue the slog?
It's been a rough time, definitely. I struggle personally with depression, anxiety, and this semester plus COVID has made it a lot worse. And then on top of that, I have become the primary caregiver for my little sister, Madison. She has spina bifida, and so I've been helping her with school and her personal care needs, along with doing my own full-time schooling.
And she also remotely?
Yes, she is.
So you're handling your course load as well as helping your sister with hers?
Yes.
So what would you like to see the administration do?
I would just like to see them. I think a main thing is that all of our students' mental health have really been impacted by COVID and online classes and additional outside stressing factors. And I think something that UW-Madison should do would to expand their mental health programs at UHS, which is our health services. They are very understaffed with therapists, and it's a long wait to actually get in and see a therapist or a doctor to help with the symptoms of depression and anxiety right now.
So they're telling you just hang on, just wait for an appointment to become available?
Yes. When I tried to go through UHS to receive therapy, I would be on a wait list for at least 2 months.
Wow. What's able to help you until then?
I've been doing a lot of bullet journaling, which is one of my hobbies. It's kind of like make your own planner, and that's relaxing for me, and it feels productive along with being artistic. I also like spending a lot of time with Maddie. When we're home, we like to do puzzles together, and we'll watch TV together and play board games, and I do have fun with her, and I do enjoy hanging out with her.
Well, Joni, best of luck for you in the finishing out this semester, and thank you for joining us today.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for letting me be here.
Well, Davey, back to you. We heard Joni's story of, you know, not just a student, but also a caregiver, also taking care of others in her family who are navigating online school. How common is Joni's story?
Yeah, you know, talking to Joni was really eye-opening for me when I was reporting this story. And I talked to a lot of other students who maybe are not in her exact position, but have other demands on their time that, you know, beyond just being in school. A lot of students are, you know, not only taking care of themselves, but maybe they're working, you know, to pay their way through school. Earlier in the pandemic, I did a story about how the pandemic was impacting college students' mental health. And at that time, I talked to a student at UW-Milwaukee who is, you know, working to keep his family, you know, housed and to help pay the bills. And, you know, a lot of these students are, you know, worried about more than just getting A's in class and are, you know, very impacted by this lack of a break as well.
Yes. We're speaking with Davey Shastri, the statewide higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's reported on several schools around the state opting to cancel spring break this year. And we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. If you're a college student, how did your school handle break? Did you agree? How'd you handle it? 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, email us at ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Stay with us. You're on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz. Right now, we're talking with Davey Shastri. She's a higher education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she reported on many colleges around the state opting to cancel spring break this year. Did that happen to you? 1-800-642-1234. We would love to hear from you. Well, Davey, you've spoke to several students who talked about all of these additional burdens that spring break, you know, maybe some people think students are just going to Daytona, Mexico, right? They're just gonna let loose. But your story really paints another picture. It describes all of these additional responsibilities that many college students have. What have university administrators said in response to these concerns?
Yeah, I think that was one of the biggest takeaways and kind of eye-opening moments for me, is that talking to these students, that's exactly what they were saying, that, you know, this raises a question about who we think of as the traditional college student and who we think of, what we think those students are doing during break. And, you know, administrators acknowledge that. And in my story, you know, they were willing to say that, like, they see that this lack of a break is just like everything else in the pandemic, is disproportionately impacting people who do have less privilege. And, you know, it was kind of interesting to see everybody watch that maybe unexpected consequence play out in real time when it came to these students.
And I understand that UW-Madison has implemented a pass-fail grading scheme this year.
Yeah.
What will that mean for students' GPAs?
Yeah, it seems like it's a relief for students if they opt for, you know, the pass-fail option, which, you know, it has to be for an eligible class. You know, it won't factor into their GPA, and that might be able to help them if they are struggling through a particular class. So that seems like it was a big relief for a lot of students to have that option.
Well, we've got another student on the line ready to share her perspective. Kashish Jain is a junior studying economics and public policy at UW-Madison. Welcome, Kashish.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here.
Thanks for joining us today. What was your experience with spring break?
Yeah. So I know that they gave us that beautiful one Friday off for spring break, which was not great. It was just one Friday off, and I actually had class on that day anyway. So I did not actually get that day off. I mean, it was definitely frustrating. I know people think that, I know that they must have done it out of good intentions because they wanted people not to travel during a pandemic. And I get that, but unfortunately, I don't think we can really control the actions of students because, I mean, I saw people going to Florida, like everyone I knew was in Florida anyway, because they had online classes. So there is really no restrictions there. So I think instead of just punishing the students that like weren't following guidelines, they ended up hurting everyone because no one got a break and no one got time to, you know, take a breath for their mental health, basically.
Yeah. And we have another caller joining us. We have Kalea in Madison calling in, and I understand you're a grad student.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a graduate student at the School of Education, and I was just listening in and wanted to comment that it seems like a lot of the decisions that have been made around COVID and around reopening have been directed toward undergrads. But even as a grad student, we've been affected, and I've been in my program for 4 years now, and I've never seen spring break as like a pause or a break, but more like an opportunity to catch up on everything. So that was really tricky this semester.
So what did it mean for you not having that break?
Oh, man, I just like woke up and it was 2 weeks away from the end of the semester. So suddenly drafts for finals are due. We're going to be having presentations soon. And so the semester really snuck up on me. And I just kind of looked at my planner, my calendar, and looked at all of the class specific things, but also all of my projects that I'm working on, and kind of had a mini freak out and started doing some damage control, basically sending emails to professors and colleagues, just trying to figure out what was possible with the like hours that I had prior to deadlines.
Yeah. Well, best of luck to you in your semester and getting to the finish line. Thank you so much for calling in today. Let's go next to Chris in Green Bay joining us. Hello, Chris.
Well, hello. Hi. I'm a teacher of 35 years, and I agree. Spring break is something mentally that you need, as well as physically. But I think it's that mental break to kind of reorganize your file cabinet in your brain, kind of see what you have to, as people are saying, catch up on. But also just a little bit of a diversion, because it's just so taxing as far as I don't care if you're in elementary, if you're in middle, high school, college. It's a grind. And so I cannot believe it. I think the people that make those decisions take time off themselves. You know, they have a day here, a day there. But as a student, that's very hard to do. You can't do that. So I don't think that should ever be an option to take something like that away.
Yes. Thank you, Chris, for sharing your thoughts, not just students, staff, faculty. Everyone is feeling this. Well, Kashish, I wonder if you have thoughts for the administration, what they could do at this point in the semester that would help.
I mean, I think that the pass-fail option that they provided was awesome. Like, I'm really, really happy that they were able to do that. I honestly prefer that over a spring break, just because I really think that'll help people out, like, concretely with their GPAs and things like that. Obviously, I wish we could have had both, but I appreciate that they're trying to repent for taking that away from us in the first place. I guess in terms of, like, what they can be doing more, there's always more they can be doing. I think that there's
a lot of people who don't have the financial aid that they should have because of COVID, or the mental support, or the, you know, financial support. I think there's a lot more that they could be doing, and I think they need to listen to student voices a lot more.
Well, thank you, Kashish, for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Davey, we've heard from so many people saying such similar things, sharing their experiences this hour. What do you think is going to happen next for this class?
Yeah, you know, it's going to be a rough few weeks. They still have to get through, you know, a few more weeks of classes, finals. And then I think the next big thing will be looking at how various schools handle graduation. You know, I think for a lot of students, it's sad, unfortunate to not be able to participate in a full graduation. But again, it's another moment in which colleges are having to make sacrifices and make difficult decisions in order to, you know, hopefully keep people safe and healthy. So, you know, throughout this school year, it's just been one decision like this after another, and it's really opened up a lot of big questions about, you know, listening to students and making decisions that are representative for, you know, broad sections of students versus, you know, just making a decision and going with it.
Yeah. And have you heard any response to the mental health concerns that we've heard expressed about it taking months to get an appointment?
Yeah, I actually posed that to UW-Madison, and they told me that there isn't a wait time for a lot of their mental health services. I know that they have virtual options and, you know, other efforts that they have put into place, do at your own pace kind of mental health supports. But the challenge is it's, you know, a lot of students are already worn out from sitting in front of a computer for hours on end, and, you know, engaging with, you know, things online. So I have heard from students that it's just not something that they think will be helpful. But it really is a big challenge. UW system in particular has seen a huge increase just in a few years, in terms of demand for their counseling services.
Yes.
And the next budget, they're asking for more money for stuff like that.
Yes, we will continue to follow this. Davey Shastri with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the news, discussions with loved ones who are hesitant to get the COVID-19 vaccine can be tough to navigate. A doctor joins the show with some tips for how to talk about it. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks about the future of cryptocurrency. Online currency trading is growing, and now there's a company trading on the NASDAQ. That's tomorrow at 8. But now, vaccinations are ramping up across the country. 1 in 4 Wisconsinites are now fully vaccinated. But the latest polling from Kaiser Health News shows that 17% of Americans said they'd wait and see how the vaccines went before they got one themselves. And that's in addition to the 20% of people who say they're not planning to get vaccinated. Talking about vaccinations can be emotional. We all want to feel safe, and for some of us, that means controlling what goes in our bodies. But without enough of us getting vaccinated, it's hard to see our way out of this pandemic. We want to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Are you concerned about getting the vaccine yourself? What's troubling you? Do you have friends or family members who are hesitating? How do you broach the issue? We're at 1-800-642-1234. We have with us Dr. Jorge Moreno, an internal medicine physician and assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Moreno, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Glad you could be with us. Well, I want to start off with Johnson & Johnson, this news about the pause in vaccinations. How How have you felt about this? Do you feel this is going to set back vaccination efforts?
Well, I think it could increase vaccine hesitancy across the United States. It probably will affect that. But I want to reassure listeners that, you know, there's been 7 million people about that got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And government officials, the FDA, the CDC, has been able to identify a pattern in 7 of those patients. And that's pretty impressive. Out of 7 million, they were able to pinpoint 7 cases that looked a little different, and they want to have more information about it. So I think that taking a breather, taking a pause right now is the best step to get this all evaluated with time.
But do you worry at all that people will hear the kind of top line information, the headline, the Johnson & Johnson unsafe and blood clots and potential complications, and maybe not hear the more nuanced information that you're sharing, the fact that this was a 1 in a million situation? Do you worry about that as a public health communicator?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that it is concerning. You know, I think that the hesitancy has actually started to come down. And so this news does bring it up into my mind. And, you know, you have to really try to communicate the message as clearly as and transparently as you can. So absolutely, I think that there is some a potential for people to have more questions. But I want to, again, reassure everyone that having questions is totally appropriate and totally reasonable. And we just have to address those questions and see what concerns people have about the vaccine.
Sure. What communities have you heard from that you're seeing the highest rates of hesitancy, not getting vaccinated?
Yeah, so I've seen, so the vulnerable populations, the Hispanic population, the Black community, and also rural communities have had a little bit more hesitancy than the average American. And so I've been part of some forums where there's been groups of Hispanic Americans or African Americans, and during these forums, a lot of questions come up about vaccines and what they could do in the body and what they can interact with. And so I think that, like I said before, the questions, the concerns that these people have, the patients have, are very reasonable. And I think that we just have to find a way to address it without causing them to feel like you're giving them a sermon or giving them instructions, right? I think that they have to come to that decision on their own.
Well, Doctor, we have a caller joining us. We have Dave from Silver Lake. Thanks for calling, Dave. What's your situation?
I have my parents. They're both refusing to get vaccinated, which is scary for them because obviously I love them. They're my parents, and they're both a lot older. My dad's in his 80s, my mom's in her 70s, and it's really scary, not just also for their health, but also for, you know, my son. But right before the pandemic, right in February and in March, he was hospitalized for RSV, which to this day I still think he might have had COVID. But I'm not gonna speculate. But RSV is a severe thing that affects the lungs, and for my parents to see him go through that, he's only 2 years old, and to still refuse to be vaccinated, you know, he said.
Dave, what did they say? What did they tell you as to why?
My dad is one of I'm not going to say that they're not conservatives, but they're pretty hardcore conservative, and he just refuses to acknowledge science. This has kind of always been a battle, but I never thought it would go this far to the point where he's not trusting sound science from the CDC of all things. Like, how it's like this systemic denial. And it's just, it's kind of, it's disheartening to hear, like, that the only way is to get him to come to his own conclusion that's the right one. And it's like, it seems so, it's an uphill battle that's impossible to scale.
Right, right. Well, thank you, Dave, for sharing that experience. And it sounds tough. Dr. Moreno, what advice do you have for Dave?
Yes, so I think that some of these struggles are very real, and very, you know, people are having these discussions every day. So the way I approach having a conversation with someone that's hesitant or refusing the vaccine is to really try to pinpoint what their main concern is, or main concerns are. I would really start having a conversation with Dave's parents, just like discussing what they're most concerned about. Is it the rapidity of the vaccine development? Is it that it was produced by the government? Is it, or like helped to be produced by the government? Is it that they're worried that it will interact with their medical conditions? And really try to hone in on what it is that they are potentially afraid of or very concerned about, and legitimize those concerns. Don't belittle them, and really kind of bring it full circle, right? Not only protecting them who they're older, but also protecting his son from their family from getting the illness. So I really try to stay kind of start with listening. It's hard to not put feelings and emotions and become closed-ended and try to get them on board from the first words you try to get out, but really listening to their concerns and I especially for them. And he's right, they're older, so you know, we know that 65 and older do poorer when they have COVID, and so really emphasizing those points that, you know, that the having COVID can be more serious in patients that are older than 65. And so I really would stress that, and really focusing on their main concerns and trying to answer them or providing resources for them to get those answers for themselves.
Right, right. Those high risk, he's talking about high risk groups. Do you feel, have you seen that been effective where family members are able to convince family members to do it for them, to do it to see their grandkids or to be able to have a family gathering, bring people together? Is that persuasive?
Yeah, so I think that all the pieces combined will help. My mom had some concerns initially, and you know, off the bat, I had quick conversations and again processed my own emotions about it, and just started to have those small conversations with them. And don't think that you're going to be successful with that first conversation. You have to go back and try it again in a little while later or a couple days later. But after some time and after some coaching, she had some concerns about whether the vaccine would give her COVID or the vaccine would give her would interact with her diabetes. And so myself, my sister, and some other family members, we spoke with her, and you know, now she's fully vaccinated. She and she did it on her time, and she scheduled it with our help. And so I think it's possible. I really do think that family knows, and also having their doctor or whoever they look to for advice, their religious leaders, their pastors, whoever they really value their opinion of, to really have that conversation. And also, I really encourage people that have had the vaccine to speak about their experience with patients that are hesitant about vaccines, really discussing how what the experience was like, the scheduling process, the check-in process, the vaccine, the after the vaccine. Because if you bring that to reality, then like to that reality check, the patient might, or the person might actually really feel much more at ease going through the process.
Right. I feel like those are so many of our conversations these days. How do you get an appointment? Where'd you get yours? How did it work? How'd you feel? I feel like that's so common these days as we were talking about COVID vaccinations and reluctance and hesitancy among the population and how we can vaccinate our way out of this pandemic. We're speaking with Dr. Jorge Moreno. He's an internist and an assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. How have these conversations gone for you? Have they turned into arguments? What's been effective? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz in for Rob Ferret. We're talking with Dr. Jorge Moreno of the Yale School of Medicine. He's got advice for navigating conversations with loved ones who may be reluctant to get vaccinated for COVID. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Are you choosing not to vaccinate? Do you have family members who don't want to get the vaccine? Are you talking about it? How did that conversation go? 1-800-642-1234. Well, Dr. Moreno, have you encountered patients who maybe aren't really skeptical per se, but they just have questions? They don't know how to access the vaccine.
Yeah, so a lot of times, a lot of states have done online scheduling, which millennials or like people that are very tech savvy, it's very easy to just hop on and get an appointment. But not everybody is as savvy as tech savvy to get on there and really figure out the system of scheduling an appointment. On top of that, there's a limited supply. Initially, there was even more of a limited supply, so a lot of people were frustrated at trying to access the portals of the various states and trying to get online. So access has been tough for certain communities, and I think that we can't assume that just because it's online, it's going to be accessible to urban communities, because some people may not have access to computers or a reliable Wi-Fi. Even in like rural areas, that might be a big problem too, where like reliable Wi-Fi may not be there. And so we have to come up with better ways to have these people connect to appointments. And so a lot of times that requires, whether it's walk-in appointments at vaccination sites, evening hours so that people can access it if they work during the day, or weekend hours. And so those types of that strategy can really help create more access to patients scheduling their vaccines.
Yeah. Yeah. And those websites can be tricky to navigate even with a good internet connection in the best of times. Well, we heard from Joe in Rhinelander, and he called but couldn't stay with us. And doctor, he wants to hear a convincing argument in favor of getting the vaccine. He says, you know, they haven't been fully approved by the FDA, and he's not so sure he wants to be a lab rat. What do you say, doc?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And so just to backtrack a little bit, the vaccine has been given to participants since March of 2020. I know we kind of forget that, but the vaccine has been around for over a year now. It just took a year to figure out all the details of how effective they were. So now we're close to 200 million people that have gotten the vaccine, and there are active ways to report side effects and various concerns from people that may have had anything. And so like I said earlier, like these reports have, there hasn't really been a big change in the reporting in terms of the side effects. And just to talk about Pfizer and Moderna for a second, they use a technology called mRNA, and a lot of people may get confused about mRNA and DNA and whether it interacts with their genes. But the way I explain it to patients is mRNA is kind of like showing a picture to your immune system that how to identify the coronavirus. And it's And that snapshot is memorized by your immune cells. And then you produce antibodies that really protect you against invaders like coronavirus. And that's what the purpose is. And so after that picture is given to your body, the cell degrades it and it gets rid of it. And so that that's kind of like my simplified version of mRNA and antibodies and how it works. But it's interesting that, you know, people get concerned about the effects on the body. But at this point, we've been seeing the vaccines for over a year and they've been effective and have been safe.
Right. Well, the phone lines are filling up with folks to talk to you, Dr. Moreno. Let's go to Chris in La Crosse next. Hello, Chris.
Hi. I have a daughter who's an anti-vaxxer. She didn't vaccinate her children, and she listens to some program by somebody, Kennedy, and she believes that vaccines make a ton of money for some people and that you can't trust the government, that, you know, as long as there's profit involved in it, that you can't trust the government. I don't know how to talk to her. I don't know. And then I have another daughter who is totally into vaccines. She just had two preemie twins, and she's concerned, you know, about having my other daughter see them. And it's a mess.
Chris, I'm sorry to hear that. Chris, talking about Robert Kennedy, who has been campaigning against vaccination. Dr. Moreno, what advice have you got?
Yeah, so I think that you have to be very careful who you listen to, right? And so it's often difficult to have people just kind of switch who they listen to and follow. But I think making baby steps, you know, like we've never had this before. Like we shut down everything for like close to a year, and it affected every part of our lives. And so if we really want to stop wearing masks and getting back into normalcy again, or like normality again, we really have to get try to use every single tool we have. You know, we have masks right now. Now we have the vaccines as a tool. So my advice to your listener, to Chris, is really just try to create baby steps and talk to them, try to get to their concerns, because, you know, the government and the FDA is concerned about the safety of the vaccines and how to make sure that everybody is safe getting them.
Well, Doc, I'm going to try to squeeze in one more caller before we run out of time with you. We've got Chris and Racine, who I understand actually did talk a friend into getting the vaccine. Chris, how'd you do it?
Hi, thank you. Yes, he said he wasn't going to do it. He doesn't believe in vaccines. And I said, okay, so you are going to be the human being that incubates the variant that mutates so that no vaccine will touch it and starts this whole deadly process all over again. And I said, or you can be part of the cure that knocks the virus out.
There you go, Chris. Thank you for that. We're short on time. Dr. Moreno, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think we have to be careful. You know, I think that the advice, you can be very tailored to the person. And I think that the advice she gave is accurate. The more we continue to have the virus propagate, the smarter it gets, the more it will replicate, the variants will be stronger. And as we know, the variants are everywhere right now in Midwest, Northeast. And so spiking. we really have to, it's a race, right? It's a rat race. We're trying to shut down the variants at the same time. We're trying to get the vaccines to roll out.
Dr. Moreno, that is all the time we have, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Jorge Moreno, internist and assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, President Biden set a new deadline for withdrawing U.S. troops from Afghanistan. We'll find out what that could mean for counterterrorism efforts and for the Afghan people. We'll also talk about the surge of interest in home remodeling over the past year. That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time. We'll be right back. That, dear listeners, is the sound of a very tiny frog. It's a spring peeper. And they're out and about now in many parts of Wisconsin. If you roll your windows down as you're driving near a marshy area, maybe even a country road with some water in a ditch, you may hear a chorus of them doing their thing, peeping away. Their sound has always been so hopeful to me. It means spring is really here. Spring's always been my favorite time of year. The longer days, the return of the sunshine, the light, the warmth. There's still so much promise ahead for the year. Plants and animals returning, the browns and the grays and the whites giving way to greens and purples and yellows. My forsythia bloomed last week. How about yours? My lilac trees have started to leaf out. Usually they bloom for Mother's Day. I really hope they put on a show this year. What are your spring rituals, your markers of the season? Is it songbirds? Is it baseball? The first lawnmower? The day you finally take your heavy winter coat and put it in the closet for good? I hope you can get out and enjoy the spring. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Molly Stenz, and you're listening to Central Time.